Lecture 8, Voltaire at Ferney.
Let us talk now about one of the most remarkable periods of any thinker's life, and that is Voltaire's period at Ferney from roughly 1759 or 60 until the year of his death in 1778. And first, note that this most influential and in many ways most dynamic period of Voltaire's life begins when he is 65 years old. It is from that point on that he will become the figure who perhaps more than any other demonstrated that the pen can be mightier than the sword. We left Voltaire after his humiliating departure from the court of Frederick the Great of Prussia, unable to settle anywhere, wandering from host to host, but with France forbidden to him by the royal authorities, by the friends of Frederick throughout Europe, Voltaire finally bought an estate in Switzerland, and then in 1759 purchases, and by 1760 has settled into a large seigneurial estate on the French-Swiss border at Ferney, the community of which is now called Ferney-Voltaire, and is dominated in its town square by a statue in which he is not only the patriarch, but he is identified as the benefactor of Ferney. Voltaire already had been formally ennobled by positions he had attained as historiograph of the king and other royal favors during periods when he was well received at Versailles, but he now becomes the owner of feudal seigneurial land that itself conveys nobility, and he throws himself into being the seigneur of Ferney. Many historians and critics focus a great deal on one relationship in particular with the woman who was unofficially the female head of household at Ferney, Madame Denise. She is Voltaire's widowed niece. Earlier in life, they had been lovers. This should not overly scandalize. In the 18th century, there are many a celebrated marriage between uncles and nieces. And the nature of that relationship by this point in Voltaire's life seems far more domestic than passionate. But she is the hostess of Ferney. And at Ferney, they create an atmosphere that is singular both for Voltaire and for anyone who visits there. Voltaire constructs a theater in which some of the leading productions, his own and the works of others, by some of the leading actors of Europe, though Voltaire himself occasionally will play a role, are performed. It is a life dominated by conversation, by peace for Voltaire, and the organization of life to giving him time and appropriate circumstances to work, and by an extraordinary attendance by Voltaire to his domain and to the well-being of those who are his tenants and peasants at Ferney. He is by this time a person of exceeding wealth. It is very difficult to translate French livres and louis into 20th century dollars. Suffice it to say that Voltaire's income in terms of its purchasing power would be very close to $1 million a year today. He is a person of quite remarkable means. And he is now Europe's most famous and celebrated thinker, with a court in effect of his own at Ferney. And there is an endless stream of visitors to pay court at that center. From France, England, Switzerland, Germany, Italy, including Casanova, Russia, including a whole mission sent by the Empress Catherine, visitors by the hundreds and hundreds. They are usually received for conversation at meals. Voltaire rarely takes time away from his life of work. They include ministers of state, crown princes, leading diplomats and magistrates, liberal aristocrats who are central to the projects of reform in Europe, and even a goodly sprinkling of theologians, and indeed many, since it is close, Protestant pastors from Geneva. His peasants being overwhelmingly Catholic, Voltaire, true to his own themes of religious toleration, not only builds them a Catholic church, but hires at his own expense a full-time priest who is a member of his household. The man's name is Father Adam, Le Père Adam. He must be the brunt of all of Voltaire's frequent theological humor, though the two men clearly come to love each other. And Voltaire, who always likes to start things with wit, is forever introducing him to new visitors as, "Here is Father Adam, though he is not first among men." Most striking to visitors, and indeed to posterity, is the stone that is placed high on the steeple of that church that says, "Deo erexit Voltaire," built for God by Voltaire. Within the church, there are beautiful Christs and deeply Christian artwork that Voltaire brings in for the peasants of his church and for his Catholic visitors, but there it is for the world to see, Deo erexit Voltaire, built for God by Voltaire. As one 19th century Voltairean said, one verb between two great names. At Ferney, Voltaire becomes the model landlord. He cares passionately about the well-being of his tenants and works often with extraordinary success from the beginning to free them from the painful burden of taxes and customs duties, to free them from the ecclesiastical tithe that should be paid to local church lands. He brings in industry, tanneries, watchmakings. He engages in constant agricultural improvement and improvement in animal husbandry. He builds houses and he seeks to secure justice for his tenants, above all when they have difficulty with ecclesiastical or other seigneurial or local courts. Indeed, he is such a model landlord that there is a great influx of tenants who wish to work the land at Ferney or own a part of Ferney and be under the seigneurial authority of Voltaire. The scope of Voltaire's influence increases throughout this entire period of life, from the age of 65 to 74. He becomes the crusader for the causes of the Enlightenment, and the role of his works is simply extraordinary. He writes during this period over 100 major works and countless pamphlets and brochures, and working 10 hours per day, almost every day, and frequently in bed, one of his favorite places to work, he floods Europe that eagerly awaits his writings with work after work. What has made it often difficult for the historian is that almost none of these works appears under Voltaire's own name. There will be no official prosecution of him. In his own mind, he is determined. There will be no return to the Bastille or its equivalent. The works are sometimes anonymous, and infuriating so many, most often pseudonymous, attributed to this or that cleric, sometimes real, sometimes made up, a community of theologians, a dead scholar, a work recently found, and the sorting out of what Voltaire did or did not write would have been a very difficult industry if he were not always so careful in his correspondence to make certain that his friends in Paris knew what he had written and what he had not. And indeed, since his works are such bestsellers, many authors publish under his name or will spread rumors that a given work is a pseudonymous work by Voltaire. So he sorts this out carefully through letters to his friends, and those friends are well placed in Paris, and indeed to foreign courts, he will let them know. But his pen is awaited and it is feared. For he has reached a time in his life when he wishes to name the names of the villains and heroes of Europe. Equally important is the role of his correspondence. As I said earlier, we have 20,000 extant letters by Voltaire out of what the best estimates are of 40,000 written during his lifetime, and he is never a more assiduous letter writer than during the period at Ferney. He has over 1,700 correspondents from peasants to kings. And in that correspondence, he incites people to the cause. He rails against injustices. He makes proposals for reform. He offers encouragement to young authors. The correspondence, as well as the works, is a major source of his influence. He makes certain causes above all else his own. Religious tolerance, toward which we will return. The horror of torture in the judicial system of France and Europe. The reality of residual serfdom in France and serfdom and slavery elsewhere. A judicial system that is stacked against innocence and that rewards vice and war. He will write to Catherine the Great against serfdom. He will write to Frederick the Great against war. He will write to ministers in towns about persecutions in their own areas. He will undertake the defense of those whom he believes have acted on behalf of humanity. The French, for example, execute an admiral who, knowing his fleet would be destroyed, holds it back from a battle and is hanged to encourage the others to being more active. Voltaire is seared by that and will undertake the defense of the memory and reputation of Lally Tollendal. And a few months before his death, that rehabilitation officially will occur. Voltaire is no longer simply French. He belongs at this point to Europe. He is the model of the cosmopolitan Enlightenment thinker of the 18th century. He is in close touch with Frederick the Great, despite their prior break, with Catherine, with rulers, crowned heads, crown princes throughout Germany, with statesmen, and his audience is increasingly European, indeed worldwide. He learns that the power to shame with indignation and anger those who have affronted justice and humanity, and to do so before a vast European audience so that a continent's thinkers and readers are damning one or praising one, that this is a powerful weapon, and he uses it to the fullest. He also, during this period, truly does become, both by age and influence and wealth, the patriarch of the Enlightenment. When he receives young writers of merit in Ferney, they often discover, when they leave, a roll of gold coins in their valises. He becomes a critic, separating out for European readers who are the authors of merit and who are the people not worth reading. To be a recipient of Voltaire's patronage, to have a letter published that he makes public, singing the praises of one's work on behalf of reform or against torture, on behalf of peace or against religious intolerance, can make a reputation. Voltaire's praise of a book can turn it into a bestseller. Voltaire has one of the most remarkable relationships with an audience that the world of thought ever has seen. And indeed, not only will he identify them for them, what he has and hasn't written among the works out there, if he believes that some of his works are being misunderstood, he will even publish commentaries by a pseudonymous author upon works that he, as a pseudonymous author, had written. And always the correspondence. He now sets the causes and the moments to dig in and fight for the Parisian philosophes, with whom he is in constant communication, both by their visits and through his communication with them in the correspondence, although there is a growing independence of the younger generation of Parisian philosophers with him, who often see him as too moderate, as too much a figure of the past. So there are limits to his power. New schools of thought in Paris that Voltaire does not approve of, and his enemies at court who can make things difficult for those selling his books, and the art of getting manuscripts to publishers and works smuggled into France becomes a very highly developed art, and the power of the devout, of the Orthodox in the court of France and in the law courts of France, whose power will wax and wane, and who can set real limits on Voltaire's power, both by their persecution of his books, but also by their persecution of his friends. He is so prolific during this period, but one work that in some way is a window into his mind at Ferney, that will be reissued in edition after edition with revisions, and is one of the best sellers of the 18th century, is his philosophical dictionary, the Dictionnaire Philosophique, arranged in its articles alphabetically, which some in the 18th century call the reason by the alphabet. The Philosophical Dictionary is a profoundly revealing and influential work simultaneously. We see in it that Voltaire, after the period of the Lisbon earthquake and Candide, has made his peace with philosophy. The problem of evil remains insoluble. There is a God. There should not be evil in the world. There is evil in the world. And how that could be is, he will pronounce in the Philosophical Dictionary, a problem that cannot be decided by the court of man's mind. But whatever the limits of human knowledge, and the Philosophical Dictionary can be quite ferocious beyond how far beyond the limits of human knowledge most philosophers attempt to go. There are the accomplishments of knowledge and science and advancement in our mastery of the world and of nature. And there is, all the articles attest, the need for free thought and skepticism, for the power of critical free thought to struggle against prejudice, prejudgment, the tendency of the human mind to believe what it has inherited from the past without examination, without critical examination. It is the role of free thought and skepticism to overcome the presumptive authority of the past over human minds and the tendency to believe uncritically. And there is a need for free thought and skepticism in the struggle against what for Voltaire is the human tendency to superstition, to believe things that are fabled, fabulous, beyond any possibility of human knowledge, what he calls the absurdities and follies of the human mind. In the Philosophical Dictionary, we see a Voltaire who expresses himself so much more freely than he ever has in his life. There is a radical outrage that permeates the Philosophical Dictionary, a new tone of candor in the intensification of his anti-sectarian thought and in the intensification of his anti-clericalism. Let's use two examples, forgive my translation. One, an article on the institution of the abbot, the abbe, a place of great wealth for the aristocratic sons of France. If they are named abbots, they get the benefices of a church's revenues, the tithe, the taxes, the exploitation of the land, and often they just hire someone to tend to the spiritual needs of their flock. Here is how Voltaire concludes his article, Abbé. A man sworn to poverty, who as a result becomes a sovereign lord. We already have said it. We must say it 1,000 times more. The laws declaim against this abuse. Religion is repelled by it. And the truly poor, without clothing or food, cry to heaven at the door of Monsieur l'Abbé. Voltaire notes that the abbots reply, but why shouldn't we look at the bishops? Look at the popes. They too took vows of poverty. They too were once indigent, but look at them now. And it leads to the final words of that article, quote, "You are right, messieurs. Invade the earth. It belongs to the strong or clever who divide it. You have profited from the times of ignorance, superstition, and madness to despoil us of our inheritances and to trample us beneath your feet, to fatten yourself on the substance of the unfortunate. Only tremble lest the day of reason arrive," end quote. That is a new voice for Voltaire, and it is one that sounds so loudly throughout the Philosophical Dictionary. There are articles of great calm. There are articles of detached humor and whimsy on matters of theological abuse. But the appearance of this direct, mordant anger marks a turning point in Voltaire's polemical and intellectual life. In one article on Lent, he talks about the theological belief that the man who eats fillet of sole at his rich table in Catholic France will be saved. But the poor wretch who eats a few pennies worth of saltback pork will be damned to hell. And he expresses himself as follows. Why do we need our bishop's permission to eat eggs? What bizarre aversion do bishops have for omelets? Can one believe that there have been Catholic tribunals so imbecile, cowardly, and barbaric that they have condemned to death poor citizens whose only crime was to have eaten horse flesh during Lent? What is bizarre is that the judges who pronounced such punishments believed themselves superior to the Iroquois. Idiotic and cruel priests, to whom do you command the observation of Lent? The rich, they can observe it all year. The poor, they have it all year long. The impoverished peasant almost never eats meat and cannot afford to buy fish. Fools, when will you reform your absurd laws? These are the articles that most caught the attention of contemporaries, and to judge by all anthologies of the 19th and 20th century, posterity as well. But in fact, the dictionary covers a very wide range of topics. It has major important articles in the arts and letters on drama, on literary quarrels, on genres of literature, on the world of letters. It has serious articles on theology and philosophy, on religion and the clergy. It has major and important articles on politics and society. And the audience of Europe, so eager for everything from Voltaire's mind, devours the dictionary in edition after edition and talks about, writes about, comments on almost all of these articles. But it is that new tone and that new sharpness on religious power and abuse that catches the most attention. There is a certain paradox to Voltaire at Ferney, for he becomes an extraordinary combination of a simultaneous hot, white, righteous indignation and calm and peace. Voltaire has never been more angry in his life. Indeed, this is the cultivation of the human garden promised at the end of Candide. He has no patience for unnecessary suffering and death and persecution and war. He has a hair trigger of righteous indignation upon which victims of abuse of power in Europe can count. But Voltaire also has never been more at peace than he is during this last generation of his life at Ferney. There is, perhaps for the first time, a self-acceptance in Voltaire, a sense of who he is, what he can and can't do, what he will and won't be. There is a certain optimism now about his role and influence. He will not have the ear of the King of France, but he has the ear of power, and he has the ear of two generations of readers who can make for change and reform and the ease of suffering in the world. And finally, there at Ferney, in his own more literal human garden, there are the consolations of living well. What he had first written about at the Société du Temple as a young man: good food, good company, love, and above all, friendship. He has these things now in abundance. Thank you.